This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The McLaughlin Group, the Capital Gang, Crossfire, This Week with David Brinkley are strongholds of what my guest describes as the punditocracy. What passes for reasoned debate on such shows, he says, is often nothing more than theatrical shenanigans. Instead of enlightening us, they're dragging down the level of American political discourse. Eric Alterman is the author of the new book, Sound and Fury, The Washington Punditocracy and the Collapse of American Politics. Alterman is critic-at-large for World Policy Journal and has been published in The Washington Post, Harper's, and The New Republic. Here's what he means by punditocracy.
The punditocracy is a group of mostly white, middle-aged, conservative men who live in Washington and have been anointed by the media to give us their opinions on the news and help, in fact, shape the debate in Washington over the issues.
Let's look at punditry in the age of television. You think of Agronsky and Company as the show that started what you call the pundit sitcom. Could you explain that?
Well, for a long time, television didn't know how to use pundits. Pundits were exclusively in the newspapers since the job was really invented in large measure by Walter Lippmann in the 1930s. And finally, because people, they needed some sort of emotional attachment to the pundits in order for the television stations to justify having them on, because otherwise people, they weren't making money, they weren't getting interest in the viewers. So it took a very long time until, I guess, the 1960s before the producers of the Agronsky show, it was called Agronsky and Company, happened upon this formula of pundit sitcoms where each pundit would play a role. I mean, these roles were usually close to the actual personalities of the pundits themselves, but that was almost irrelevant. Sometimes they were, sometimes they weren't. But they would each have sort of a role like any sitcom character, and that way viewers could relate to them as characters and listen to what they had to say and sort of look them up each week to see how they were doing.
Now, you think that the David Brinkley Sunday Show kind of falls into this pundit sitcom style in a way. You know, the conversation at the end with Sam Donaldson and George Will and David Brinkley.
That part does, yeah. The rest of it, I think, is legit.
Yeah, so who's who if it's a political sitcom there?
Well, David Brinkley, I think, is sort of the old grandfather, who's a little bit sardonic, a little bit of a wiseacre, but is generally considered wise and knowing. And I think he fell into that role largely because when Walter Cronkite retired, that role was open for the American, for sort of the American psyche. The two things happened almost simultaneously. I think George Will is, he's been described two ways that I use in the book. One is as an usher at a Whiffen Poofs concert, and another one is as a national version of the smartest boy in the class. He's the guy who's always raising his hand up, sitting in the front of the room, with his bow tie on, saying, "I've got the answer, I've got the answer," and then showing off that he really understood the question better than the teacher did. Sam Donaldson is I think, Eddie Haskell. He's the guy.
Yeah, how is he Eddie Haskell? Yeah.
Yeah, he's sort of shooting spitballs at the teacher. And when they call on him for the question, he sort of, he gets a little befuddled and he tries to bluster his way out of it. And sometimes he does and sometimes he doesn't.
I think it's fairly well known that George Will and George Bush don't really care for each other. I don't know how much you know about this, but is that mostly political or are there personal things mixed in there too?
Neither one has confided in me. But my opinion of it is this, is that Nancy Reagan never liked George Bush. She thought he was a weenie. And Nancy and George Will were very close. And in fact, the famous column that George Will wrote when he called George Bush a lapdog in 1986 was written immediately after he had lunch with Nancy Reagan the day before, as far as I recall. I may be wrong about that, but very, very shortly thereafter. And I think that Will doesn't really have any major philosophical agreements with Bush. In many ways, he's closer to Bush than he was to Reagan. But Will had what I call a cojones problem in Washington. Will was seen as having been emasculated by his incredibly close relationship with the Reagans and the indulgences he offered them, even though he didn't have any real respect for Reagan's intellect. And he needed to prove himself that he could be an independent journalist, and so I think he took it out on poor George Bush.
It's been interesting to watch him cross-examining people in the Bush administration. He asks really tough, pointed questions. And with some of those questions, if you didn't know better, you might think, well, this guy must be a liberal.
Yeah, well, Will is he's a liberal in certain ways. Will Let's give credit where credit is due. Will is one of the only pundits, one of the only people in American public life who has mapped out a coherent political philosophy and stuck to it. And his political philosophy is not the philosophy of Reaganism. It's not the philosophy of the Republican Party. George Will cares about the public realm. He cares about the quality of life for society as an organism. And so he thinks, he supports many social programs that most conservatives don't, and he believes that society has a responsibility to the poor and to the less fortunate. I have difficulty with the way he defines that society. I think he basically thinks of society as upstanding white Christian folk. I don't think he has any regard for homeless people or people he can't relate to personally. But I do admire the sort of consistency and the tenacity with which he's tried to define this view, despite the fact that almost nobody in the Reagan administration or in the Democratic Party shares it. And I think it's a coherent view. It's a view of sort of British Tory, which I think Will truly is.
All right, let's get to the McLaughlin Group. And you described this show as having broken several pundit barriers.
What the McLaughlin Group did is that it created a new level of celebrity in Washington. It created the Washington version of Hollywood starlets. And that's who the McLaughlin Group guys were. And they would have parties, and the president would come and make jokes about them. And these jokes are written by former members of the McLaughlin Group. And the whole thing was incredibly chummy. John McLaughlin would have the president and his wife over for dinner. His wife was in the cabinet. And it created this new class of pundits, which was far beyond anything we had seen previously when the Agronsky show was the only way to do it. And it opened up, because there was this rotating chair that McLaughlin would fill occasionally, it opened up the ambition of being a rich and famous pundit to lots of journalists who otherwise didn't have it. And so the McLaughlin Group, what I call the McLaughlin Group virus, infected all of Washington journalism. Because everybody in Washington wants to be rich and famous. I mean, so do I. Just not that way.
You know, I think of the McLaughlin Group as almost like a wrestling program, in the sense that wrestling is choreographed. You assume that it's fixed, yet there's all this kind of posturing about who's going to win, and everybody's acting really tough, but the whole thing's totally staged. And somehow, the McLaughlin Group comes off in a really similar way, as it being like a lot of posturing.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I used to watch wrestling, and I was very attached to Bruno Sammartino, who was the Worldwide Wrestling Federation champion, probably in like 1966. And when I found out it was fixed, I was very disappointed and very angry, and I felt sort of alienated from my hero. And my mother said to me, "Eric, big deal, it's only wrestling." And the problem with the McLaughlin Group is that it's not only wrestling. It's our public dialogue. It's our democracy. And as I said, it wouldn't matter if all it was a show about a bunch of jerks throwing, you know, verbal food at one another. But what it is it's a defining term, it's a defining feature of our intellectual debate in Washington. As pathetic as that sounds, it's really true. Leon Wieseltier, who's the literary editor of the New Republic and as smart a guy as you'll find anywhere in Washington, says that the most important influence on the New Republic since Walter Lippmann is the McLaughlin Group.
Why does it have that kind of influence when, just judging it on a theatrical level, it almost seems like the participants don't take what they're saying seriously?
Well, they don't, and that's always how they defend themselves when you tell them that they're, you know, that they're damaging the body politic in any way. They say, well, it's just a dog and pony show and it's not hurting anyone. But I think that's not true. I think that, first of all, the idea of setting up two reporters who are either conservative or apolitical as the liberals has the effect of shutting out true liberalism from the public debate and making the debate exclusively on the right, which is what happened during the 80s. And I think that the McLaughlin Group both reflected that and also pushed that forward. I also think, this is the point I was trying to make a minute ago, that it's important simply because it's what everyone aspires to be. Now, let me give you an example. I happen to be the person who was the first person to go deeply into the story of John McLaughlin's sexual harassment charges and find the women who, some of the women who had alleged that he had sexually harassed them, and explain why it mattered. And I think it came to matter even more during the Anita Hill controversy when McLaughlin attacked her credibility. Now, why was I the person to do that? I'm not a great investigative journalist. I'm not Bob Woodward. But the reason is that nobody really wanted to go after McLaughlin because John McLaughlin controlled the McLaughlin Group. He controlled access to riches and fame as Washington journalists conceive of it. And so it's not that It's not that they were terrified of McLaughlin, that he was going to do something to hurt them. It said, why bother? Why take someone on who's one of the only people who can really set your life up in such a way that you get paid, you know, $20,000 an hour to give a talk? I'm not exaggerating at all. So I think that because of the power and influence that McLaughlin wielded, and the relationship he had with politicians, particularly Ronald Reagan, that this show became enormously influential inside Washington, even though you couldn't find a single human being, Ronald Reagan included, who would say that it in any way swayed their opinions.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Alterman. He's written a new book on the Washington punditocracy. It's called Sound and Fury. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Eric Alterman is my guest, author of a new book about Washington pundits. Well, a point you make is that a lot of people within politics in Washington feel that they can only address issues that the pundits are addressing because those are the only issues that are really considered to be on the political agenda.
Right.
And if the politicians talk about something else, it's just they're afraid it's going to be ignored.
Right. Well, I have the story in the book of James Fallows, who's, I guess, known to your audience as a writer, but who used to be a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. And at one point, he tried to get some obscure issue into Jimmy Carter's speech, and it was vetoed, either by Carter or by one of his bosses. And so Fallows ghost wrote an editorial about the issue in the New Republic, and after that, they said, oh, okay, this is a real issue. The New Republic is interested in it. And he got it into the speech. And I think that's a very nice, neat example of the way Washington works.
Do you think that there are things politicians try to do to influence the pundits?
Oh, certainly. I mean, they fight for that seat on the Capitol gang that's open to the politicians. They're thrilled when, on the rare occasions, they get invited to the McLaughlin group. And in election time, you see, elections are a little bit more complicated because the pundits play a slightly different role. In between elections, the 4 years between elections, pundits basically are the democracy. Americans don't have any idea which faction we're supporting in Cambodia or Mozambique, and they shouldn't. And so they have better things to worry about. And so the pundits basically decide what's okay and what's not, which is why, you know, we've been doing some crazy things for the past 12 years, in my opinion. But during the election, the American people are invited into the process after a while. And so the role the pundits play is the winnowing out of that process, of choosing what candidates and what issues are going to be important in that election before the people are ever invited in. And I use the example in my book of... the guy is my best friend who told me. His name is George Stephanopoulos, and he's the communications director for the Clinton campaign. And when Clinton was selling himself to the pundits before he ever sold himself to the electorate, he went before the Washington Post editorial board, and he told them that he supported the Reagan defense buildup, which was very important to them. He went before an important group of Washington journalists at a breakfast. I think it was Christian Science Monitor's bureau chief, Godfrey Sperling's breakfast, and told them how strongly he supported the Gulf War, which was actually not clear at the time. And then he made a speech at Georgetown University, which was very strongly in favor of continued use of force, of unilateral force in American foreign policy. Now, what the campaign decided to do was to leak that speech a little bit early to the New York Times reporter Les Gelb, who was very, very influential in foreign policy matters within the punditocracy. I have no idea who reads Les Gelb in America, but I know he's read very carefully in the punditocracy. Les Gelb approved of the speech, and he approved of Bill Clinton on the basis of the speech and on the basis of who his advisors were. And that column of Gelb's giving Clinton his seal of approval resounded throughout the punditocracy and was very important as one of the building blocks of Clinton becoming the pundit's favorite candidate, which was very, very important once he got into trouble in New Hampshire over Jennifer Flowers in the draft. The pundits supported him. They said that Jennifer Flowers didn't matter, which I agree with. But as I keep saying, it worries me a great deal when I agree with these guys. They said that the Vietnam thing was old news and didn't matter. It's 23 years ago. Well, that's true. I agree with that, too. But these are the same guys who've been telling us for the past 20 years that Vietnam was the most important thing that ever happened to us. And if we had only stuck to our guns in Vietnam, we'd be a great country instead of a joke to the Soviet Union. And they also did something very interesting for Clinton, which I try and describe in the book, is that they declared him the winner in New Hampshire, even though he came in second. People probably don't even remember that he didn't win New Hampshire, but I remember watching one night Jeff Greenfield, Nightline's pundit, he came on the air and he said, this is a few weeks after New Hampshire, and he said, we've had four primaries so far and four winners, five if you count Bill Clinton in New Hampshire. Well, why in the world would you count Bill Clinton in New Hampshire? He didn't bother to explain. It wasn't necessary. You were counting Bill Clinton because that's who the pundits wanted to win.
If you look at the field of, let's say, television pundits, how balanced do you think the punditocracy is between the left, the right, and the center?
I think it's very well balanced between the right and the center. There's very few voices from, there's really no voices from the left. There are some liberal voices, but in my opinion, they're not taken very seriously. They're sort of token liberals. But what's most often done is that someone who is just left of center, who doesn't quite agree with what the center of administration debate is, will be cast as a liberal in order to disown any views to the left of that.
Why do you think it is that there are so few, if any, people who really represent the left in the punditocracy?
Well, I think part of it is the fashions of the times. The producers and the editors were looking for people who could speak for what they thought was a Reagan revolution in the 1980s, and so conservatives just had a leg up. I also think that pundits can read election polls as well as state legislatures, and that many formerly liberal pundits became conservative as a result of the fashion, that they sort of switched their tune. I think Morton Kondracki of the McLaughlin Group and the New Republic is kind of a weather vane. He was a liberal during the early Carter era and then became a conservative, and now is actually, I would say, a little bit confused. So I think there's both of those things. And I also think that there's a lot of pressure on these shows and on the op-ed pages to speak sympathetically about the government's program. I think if Bill Clinton is elected president, this will change again. It won't ever be to the left, and there still won't be very many powerful liberals, because Bill Clinton is a centrist, and I think he would agree with that assessment. But I think the pendulum will swing back somewhat, and I think you can see that today in the punditocracy. These guys are not anywhere as near as belligerent as they were 5 years ago towards the rest of the world, and they are far more concerned with the domestic economy than they used to be, even though, in my view, all of these trends that we're talking about in terms of the decline of our economy were visible 5 years ago, or certainly 4 years ago.
You make the point in your book that you think one of the problems in the political dialogue today is that journalists are supposed to be objective. Therefore, no matter how informed they are, if they're still in a reporting capacity, they can't participate in the debate because they're officially not supposed to have opinions.
Right. Well, you know, I've said for a while, whenever I meet a New York Times reporter in some country, I'm always amazed at how smart he is and how well he understands the problems that he or she is writing about, because I very rarely see evidence of this contextual understanding in reporting in the New York Times or anywhere else. I'm very critical of the whole notion of objectivity. I think it's a hoax. I think it invests newspapers and television programs and radio programs with a kind of authority that is farcical and undeserved. But it actually does things which are worse than that and more complicated. What I think objectivity does is it divorces people from the subjects they're reading about. It tells them that there's like this wall between their lives and what's being written about. And so they lose interest in it because they don't see any relevance to their own lives, which is why I think sports writers who are much more passionate about their subject get people's attention and get people excited about their subject much better than political reporters. The second thing that objectivity does is it takes away the people who understand the subject the best, the people who cover it on a day-to-day basis, from offering us solutions about how to solve our problems. So we end up with pundits who really don't know very much about it at all, maybe nothing at all. And they're offering us ignorant opinions, which then shape the debate. So it's my opinion that if we gave up on this notion of objectivity as false, we'd accomplish a few very important things. We would first of all get rid of the punditocracy, because who needs to listen to John McLaughlin tell you about Nicaragua when someone who's been living in Nicaragua for 2 years and covering it as an honest journalist can do it. Number two is we'd get people excited about politics again, because we would make it more like a baseball game, and people would feel invested emotionally in politics. And I think that the kind of anger that we've seen this year at the entire system, I think that this is one important way to address it. And third of all, I just think we'd have more fun. I think it would be a much more interesting political culture. People always say 100 years ago, Lincoln and Douglas debated for 5 hours and everybody sat still for it, and what's happened to us? But what's happened to us is our entire political culture has changed, and people have by and large opted out. And you can actually date this very similarly to the beginning of objective reporting. And I would like to see a political culture like we had 100 years ago.
No, I wouldn't be the first person to point out that you sound very much like a pundit yourself.
Yeah.
And you've been called by one person, a mini pundit or even a meta pundit of
right.
The punditocracy.
But you see, that's old news. Since I was on the Today Show, I'm now the anti-pundit, which I like much better.
Oh, the anti-pundit, okay.
That's what my friend Stone Phillips called me. You know, I knew I was going to get asked this, and I tried to think up a cute answer for it before I went on this tour. And the only thing I can think of is it's like calling the cops robbers, because they're at the bank with their guns out at the same time, and their guns are drawn and they're shooting. But you know, I'm shooting for different reasons, and I think that to say that I'm doing the same thing they are is sort of silly. When you consider that, how else would it be possible for me to get this message out? I don't have my own network. I don't have my own show. If I'm going to write a book about it, you know, spend 4 years at home in my room writing a book about it, the only way to get people's attention is to sound like a pundit. So I plead guilty with explanation.
If you were offered a pundit-type job on a regular basis on a network, would you want to take it?
Depends on how much money they offer me. No, I'm kidding. It would depend a great deal on the format. I mean, we do need... Walter Lippmann spent most of his life trying to figure out how to make complicated political issues understandable for people who don't have time to study them all day.
Yeah.
And I am troubled by this myself. I don't understand exactly what a democratic foreign policy would look like, even though I very much think we should have one. I don't know how you would get a democratic foreign policy when people don't have access to good information. So I'm not averse to finding ways and participating in ways whereby I can make politics more intelligible to people who don't have the time that I do to study it. But it would depend a great deal on the format. If John McLaughlin turns his show over to me, I think I'd turn him down. I hope I would anyway.
Okay. Well, Eric Alterman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Eric Alterman is the author of the new book, Sound and Fury, The Washington Punditocracy and the Collapse of American Politics. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.